The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
That's a dream team.
Exactly.
Right there.
Without any one of us, it's not We the People. It's more like We the Wounded. we're either missing music or we're missing something. It requires all of us.
It takes a village.
I was going to avoid saying that.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So, sorry we had to...
Did you hear that your whole life?
No, but I've heard it a lot since I was a grown-up.
Oh.
I was actually really good when I was a kid, unlike you, carving...
Not like what I heard.
Carving BBs out of small children.
Let's just not go there. I just had to bring that up one more time. Yeah, let's not bring that up.
People enjoyed that.
Yeah, I didn't crash a car over a wall in somebody's yard.
Yeah, there was that.
Yeah.
Rut-row. My dad's new station wagon, the only new vehicle he's ever owned.
Yeah. And don't drive fast. Yeah. Okay, Pop.
Well, it wasn't really that, but yeah, there were a lot of circumstances. But you know what? Station wagons don't fly well.
No, they don't. They're not very aerodynamic.
But you know what? They will rip through a hedge.
They land well.
I left a hole in the hedge that looked like cartoons. It's like where the body goes through and the arms are out. Yeah, it wasn't good.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did we get onto this?
I don't know. You were picking on me, and I fired back. So
yeah.
So what are we doing today? We're going to talk about wolves.
Yes, more on wolves. Actually, we have we have talked about this subject before. So for all the people who go, oh my lord, they're not going to talk about wolves again. Yeah, we are. The music will be fun. You'll like that part. And bottom line is, if you eat meat, you're going to find out why your beef price is going to go through the roof if we don't deal with this situation, because we have John Williams with us, who is a, let's see, I'll read you his thing. He's an associate professor in the Department of Rangeland Resources at Oregon State University. He works as a natural resources extension agent in Wallowa County. He holds a bachelor's in animal science and a master's in agriculture and animal science. Sure, easy for you to say. And he's on there. So hopefully this is all correct. And he ranched for 15 years and has been an extension agent for like 29, I was guessing, because we had to up it from last time. The last time we had John on was the January 27th of 2013. I couldn't believe it's been that long. So he's been...
We were just talking about the possibility of having wolves at that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was, well, they were...
We knew they were coming, but they weren't here yet.
We were talking about it, but the actual agencies were saying, we're not doing that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're here.
So he's done tons of study on how wolves affect the ranching community, a.k.a. your future beef prices. And I think you'll be surprised at some of the information. So we've posted some of it on here. We have one thing that has not been able to be published yet that I think he's going to talk to us about. Estimates of economic losses to stock growers due to the presence of wolves in northeastern Oregon.
Yeah, and it's much more than just the loss of the steer or the calf or the cow.
It goes way beyond that. Absolutely. So how you doing this morning, John?
Doing good.
Oh, sorry, it's afternoon. I keep forgetting. We were a morning show for like 2 years, and I can't make the transition. So where would you like to start?
Well, I thought maybe we'd just start with some of the most recent happenings in Oregon about wolves. Some of them are political, and some of them are not. The first thing, or the most recent thing, is that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has actually delisted wolves off the Oregon Endangered Species List. And then there was a lawsuit that was filed December 31st by three environmental groups that prompted people to actually go to the legislature and get a bill that passed to codify the delisting so that it wasn't just an agency decision, but actually now an Oregon law that delisted it that would hopefully reduce the amount of litigation that goes on.
That's nice.
So now that they are delisted, does that mean they're going to have like open season on wolves? Are they going to have some kind of regulatory action on controlling their population?
That was the interesting thing is that delisting them did nothing to change the management of the wolves.
That doesn't surprise me.
All it did was reduce the take it off of that ESA list, so that if somebody wanted to sue over, you know, whatever rules somebody wasn't following or that was perceived that they weren't following, that the Endangered Species Act in Oregon could be used, and that's no longer the case. Because we finished our short session in the legislature on Thursday, and I believe it was Wednesday night they finally passed that bill out, and it's on the governor's desk. Of course, it is never for sure until it's signed, but I'll make the assumption that it will be signed. It doesn't change how wolves will be managed at all. And in fact, in Oregon, as in all of California, they're still federally listed under the Oregon Endangered, or under the United States Endangered Species Act. And so they're still, you know, considered an endangered species. In Oregon, it's west of Highway 395, which runs from Pendleton down through John Day and over to Winnemucca. So everything west of there is still federally listed, but it's no longer on the Oregon Endangered Species Act.
How screwy.
So that would make it a felony if you did accidentally kill one. But
I don't know if it's a felony or not, but it's 5 years in prison and a $100,000 fine.
So. Oh, yeah. Just 5 years in prison? Oh.
Funny that it kind of should deter you from wanting to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I know that at the federal level there's been a lot of talk about delisting, and I'm hoping with a new administration that can be actually accomplished.
Well, it is. There was actually, you know, a recommendation to delist. They went through the process, and that seems to just be out in Never Never Land right now. Last time they heard, it was sitting and waiting for the proper bill to be attached to in D.C. I'm never sure what that means when a politician tells me that. But.
Well, my guess is it means something that the Democrats can't blow up, something that they have to have. So then if we can get something else on there, maybe we can kind of arm twist them to do it.
And that's probably it, yes.
Like, but that's why they do the budget, you know, all the omnibus at the end of the year. Unfortunately, it'd be better if it went through as individual appropriations. But, you know, in the omnibus, sometimes you have the ability to highlight something that you can't get through otherwise. Like last year, it was Planned Parenthood and Obamacare, defunding Obamacare. They were able to force a vote on those, which isn't always the case. A lot of times they get blocked. But yeah, it would be, how would it change what goes on in your state, and if you know what goes on in California or any of the others, if they were not federally listed, what would be different?
You know, in Oregon, it wouldn't be any different, and I believe so that it's the same, or it will be very soon. I don't know that you've passed your California wolf plan yet, management plan.
They haven't passed the stupid
wolf
plan.
Sure have one on the table. And both Oregon's and California's look suspiciously like ours, with some different numbers. But very, very cautious management towards making sure that these wolves will never be, you know, go downhill in numbers. And you know, in Oregon, the second thing that happened last year was that we met our criteria. Oregon's wolf plan management plan has three phases to it. And phase one was very, very, very restrictive. You couldn't even shoot one if it was chasing your cows. You could shoot one only if it was biting, if you actually caught them, what I call teeth in the meat. But beyond that, you couldn't shoot them and you couldn't harm them. And
what about people? Because that came up at all of our hearings about the wolf management plan down here, that what if they were going to harm people? And I know that that's been a problem in Idaho and Wyoming and all sorts of other states.
Well, in Oregon, we asked that question quite a few years ago, and the answer was you might be able to protect yourself. It wasn't clear under Oregon law, and because it says you may, it doesn't say you shall be able to. So I think in practicality, if you are in imminent danger, it's attacking someone else or you, I think their laws are able for you to go ahead and protect yourself. But if they're just looking at you, if they're close to you, if there isn't an aggression, who knows?
No teeth in the meat.
That's always one of those questions that, okay, I'm out camping and it's standing 50 feet from me and glaring at me. I couldn't tell you the answer to that. That's one of those gray areas.
My guess is that the whole world would think you were justified, but you'd spend a fortune defending yourself.
That's probably true.
To prove that?
Yes. So we are in phase two because in Oregon, that trigger number was 4 breeding pairs for 3 consecutive years, and we met that last January, a year ago, and so we automatically went into phase two. I do not know what your numbers in California are, but I know they're considerably higher than that before you would move into
it. They don't know either. It was interesting because I had a rancher up in northeastern California who had a game warden that wanted to come on their property, and I forget what the excuse was. And after they went around and around, like, that doesn't sound legit. What do you really? Hey, you're looking for the wolves, aren't you? And the guy's like, yeah, we are. We lost track of one of them. So, so they've already lost track of them. They don't know what they're doing. We need to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back and get into more of this. But that way we won't be super late on all our breaks. And I kind of forgot to tell everybody at the beginning that we air Sundays from noon to 2 Pacific here in California, and that's our live program. And then on the East Coast, we're Mondays from 1 to 3 Eastern Time on the Conservative Commandos Radio Network that airs on WNJC. They have a really interesting new thing. I'll just read you their little announcement. He says, now you can listen to the show and all the shows on the Conservative Commandos Network any time of the day from any phone just by calling 832-999-1199. And you don't have to install an app. You don't have to download anything. So if you have free minutes on your cell phone or, free long distance or whatever, and you'd like to listen to a bunch of really nice radio that's all conservative, you just, if you don't want that variety, you just kind of want to stick down that one lane, it's 832-999-1199. So it's kind of a neat thing. It's also on the front page of the website, which is wethepeopleradio.us. And we'll be right back.
Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? Who's that I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. Everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood. I don't think little big girls should go walking in these spooky old woods alone.
So wolf-like. Actually, I can still see my mother's face when they played that at the wedding reception. The first time I got married. It was a kind of a different plan. Anyway, so much for that. All right, John, where would you like us to go now?
Well, just one more little tidbit, and then would like to get started with a little discussion on some of the research we've done. But the wolf population in Oregon increased 36% this last year.
Wow.
That just came out. So it's been about 30% a year since it started. So that's another thing that you can probably figure works in California as well.
Do they have a number associated with that? Do they know how many are there now?
Well, they have the minimum number, I think, is the word that they use. So that's how many they count, and their statements are that they know they have more than that. But it's 110 in Oregon for 2015, and that's the official number. Mm-hmm. 12 packs, and a pack is defined as four adult animals that hang out together for at least 6 months. and then 11 breeding pairs, which is a breeding pair is defined as two adults with two pups that survive to December 31st. So all of those numbers are up significantly from the previous year.
And do you in Oregon, do they collar them, all of them?
Yes. The Oregon Wolf Plan states that they'll get collars in each pack, and that each pack will also at least have one collar. There's two kinds of collars. One's a radio collar, where you can go out on the ridge with the antenna in your hand and wander around looking for beeps. And if you, those are line of sight and probably within 5 miles of each of you. The GPS collars are the ones that upload how they can set them from 2 to 6 hours or 2 to 24 hours, to how often, that the ding goes off. And it records where it's at, and then it uploads it probably once a day, and they can keep track of it that way. But there's usually one GPS collar, in Oregon in a wolf pack, if they can keep up with that, and maybe one or two of the radio callers.
Hmm. Because we've had a big debate down here. It's interesting. Part of the ranching community thinks it would be good if they were all collared, and then, of course, the other part's kind of like, we'd kind of rather have them not as easily tracked, I think, to see when the collar goes silent. I'm just guessing.
That's the debate that's everywhere. My opinion, knowledge is important, and knowing where they're at is important. You're caught blindsided if you don't even know they're in the country. However, I recognize that in Oregon, for instance, they've been relatively aggressive, and at year end they had 12 wolves collared, which is about 11% of the population. Eight were, those collars tend to disperse. They like to put them on two-year-olds. They last a while, and then those are the dispersing animals. That's why it seems like every time us in Northeast Oregon are benevolent enough to send you guys a wolf, it seems to have a collar on it, at least the ones that we know about. And if it wasn't for having our collars, you would have probably been a year or a year and a half later before anybody would recognize there was wolves down there.
Yeah, that would have been our dream. The debate is always, the guys who want the collars think that they're going to be able to see in real time that they're getting near their property or that they're near their animals. Does that actually happen?
In Oregon, they have set up a system of polygons, which we in Northeast Oregon we didn't like at all. But since they were endangered species, they couldn't give us the exact point. So they set up polygons, and if a collar was uploaded and a sight was on in that polygon that you were running cows in, then you would automatically receive a text message about 6 in the morning saying that a wolf had shown to be in the polygon. The polygons were about somewhere between 5,000 and say 20,000 acres, which, so the collar goes off, takes a reading, maybe at 10 o'clock in the morning, And it's in that polygon the next morning at 6, so almost 24 hours later, you're going to receive a text from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that there had been activity in the polygon in the area that you're ranching.
So,
yes, some information, good information. That's the debate among the ranchers as well. Is that really useful or is it not? And probably where it becomes most useful, well, the dots on the map are most useful in the sense of when a depredation occurs and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is trying to see if it's a confirmed wolf kill. You know, if the collar happened to go off right on top of your animal, that helps a whole bunch.
Yeah, because you were saying it was, what, 1 out of 8 or 1 out of 7?
The have collars?
No, the kills that are attributed to wolves.
The Oakleaf study in Idaho showed 1 out of 8. So, okay. Yeah, if you actually find a carcass, there's probably 7 others out there that you didn't find if you're out on the range.
Yeah, that's got to be fantastic. You guys have done, for the people who obviously were not with us, like the folks in Philadelphia and all that back in 2013, give them a little bit of background on what you guys have been studying and how long you've been doing it, because this isn't just an opinion thing on your part. This is really
right.
Very science-based.
So years ago, actually in 1996, when they released the wolves in Idaho across the Hell's Canyon from us, one of our prominent ranchers in the county came into my office and said, "John, I need Oregon State's help." He said the worst, most destructive or disruptive thing known to the livestock industry is going to hit us in the future, and we need to get a handle on it ahead of time. And we didn't have, you don't get very, very many opportunities to study something before it happens. He says, we need to get a handle on these wolves. And so at that point is when I actually started working with the cattle industry on wolves. In 2008, we finally moved it into a research project between Oregon State University, the University of Idaho, and the Agricultural Research Service. We got funding from the cattlemen to buy collars and put them on cows, and it was our goal to also get collars and put them on wolves in the same area and see if we could have interactions. And what we're trying to do is to find out what is the impact on cattle when in the presence of wolves. And so that's our big overarching question. And so we started in 2008. Anybody that's worked with collar people back then, the cost of collars was $3,000 to $4,000 a piece, and we didn't have near that much money. So we put together a guy that was retired from Micron and one of my colleagues who's very good with software, and an engineer and an ag researcher, and build them pretty much in the garage, and they're about $450 or $500 a piece. And then we hung 10 collars on cows on each of 3 ranches in Idaho, and we matched them with 3 ranches in Oregon, trying to look at the comparative with wolves and without wolves actions of livestock. And the second part of that, which is still to come, is that we also were taking the pre-data on the ranches in Oregon, thinking that if we know how the cattle interact on a specific ranch, but without wolves, and then if wolves actually show up in these herds, we can put collars on after they're there and see how things have changed. So it's both a comparison A against B as well as before and after. At the present time, we actually didn't put collars on very many cattle last summer because we have enough pre-data and we have enough data for the comparative with wolves and without wolves. And so what we're doing is we're not that we want it to happen with our rancher partners here in Oregon, but if and when wolves get on cattle ranches that we've already got the before collars, we'll put those collars back on cows and we can get the before and after. And we just see how they work differently. Where do the cows go? Where do they don't go? How much do they move? And so forth. Those are the type of questions. On the big question. So we're kind of in the middle of it, and it's only been 8 years. So this is a long-term project. But we did identify that it was an adaptive management project. And that meant that every year we met with advisory committees or when we needed to, talk to them about what we had found and ask them the questions, is there something that we can do in the short run? I call it more of a master's thesis, something you might learn in 1 to 2 years. And the thing that came out emphatically was we need to find out how the temperament changes in these wolves. Around wolves. And because the ranchers were telling us that there was a distinct difference in the temperament changes. So we tried to put that project together.
Hey, John, before we go into that, let's take another quick break. And sure. I also want to let people know that on the webpage for today, where it says wolf-cattle interaction study, just down a little bit, there's a link at OregonState.edu content, wolf and cattle interactions, and that has the video of this. You can see these little dots move around, the dots that are wolves and the dots that are cattle. It's really interesting. And for those people that still think, well, it's no big deal, the wolves probably don't bother them that much, I would really encourage you to go take a look at that. And if you have friends that still think wolves are magical, whatever, you know, that whole thing, go. Especially the animal rights people. I can never figure out how the animal rights people don't get involved in this. You can see the stress. I mean, you're just watching dots move around, but you can see the panic and the running. So we'll come back to that, but in the break, if you want to take a look at it, you can go to wethepeopleradio.us, scroll down, and look at Wolf-Cattle Interaction Study. We'll be back with John Williams from Oregon State University in just a couple minutes.
In his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called E. Ho Fooks, for him to get a big dish of beef chow mein.
And we know why you won't hear him anymore. So wolves ate him. So, welcome. Did that blow the ending?
Yeah, that did.
Sorry. Sorry, spoiler alert. Hey, so you're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. And we're here with John Williams from Oregon State University, and we're talking about wolves. And for those people who are just tuning in thinking, wolves, schmolves, they don't have anything to do with me. Hey, if you eat meat, guess what? This is all about your ranching community, which is, I know this is going to be a big news flash for some folks, but that's where your meat comes from.
It does?
I know. Go figure.
I thought
huh?
It came from the grocery store.
Comes from Safeway, right?
Yeah.
So this has a huge effect on cost, and we're going to get to that in this program because that's a huge factor. But go back to the interaction study, John, because that is really... I think that kind of shuts people up, I guess, the folks that don't think it's hurting the cattle.
Sure. It's interesting. I guess I need to give credit where credit is due. I'm an extension agent, okay? I am an associate professor, but I'm an extension county agent, what people used to know for us. And I'm not necessarily that consummate researcher. And the people that are the primary researchers are Doug Johnson, who's from Oregon State University, is retired, and Larry Larson, who's from Oregon State at Eastern Oregon, is retired, and then Pat Clark, who's the Agricultural Research Service researcher over in Idaho, and Tyann Rowland, who's another extension agent over on the side of the place that has wolves. So I just wanted to make sure those people, you know, at least get recognized that they're, it's a big group of people working on this. We were talking about getting the collars on the cattle, and we put them on before they leave in the spring. The ranchers agree to put them on, and then we don't get any downloads until they come in the fall, and we take the collars off and take the SD card out and download it, just like it comes out of your camera. And we also were going to get these collars on wolves, and we had no idea just how difficult it was going to be to get permission to get collars on an endangered species. And both biologically difficult because wolves are hard to catch, but also politically and getting the permission and getting the permission at the right time and having the right information. So we've actually gotten one very good set of data from a wolf. And we recognize that it is one wolf, and he was one wolf in a pack of 12 wolves. So when you look at some of those videos, you may see cattle scurrying around or the little dots scurrying around, which are the light-colored dots. And the red dot is not close to it if you get into the 2009 videos. And that may well be that it's something else, but it also could be one of those other 12 wolves. But we did try to come up with a novel way of displaying our data. Nobody wants to, you know, sit and look at table after table, and came up with this idea of, well, let's make a, you know, animated video out of it. And so those are posted there, and they are compelling. Now, there's some things you'll see is a wolf tends to sit a lot. He will sit and go back to one spot on a regular basis or two spots. And sometimes he'll go through that herd of cows and recognize that those 10 collars is representing 350 cow herd. So again, a lot of cows out there that don't have collars on them as well. So we were trying to get an interaction between our collars and between our wolf. And in that time frame of the summer, to see what we could learn, and sometimes we saw that the wolf goes through those cows and they don't even seem to lift their head, and sometimes it goes through and chaos occurs, and so that's one of those research questions that hopefully I live long enough that somebody finds the reason for that, but it isn't every time a wolf comes through your cows that there's a significant impact. That's one thing I want to point out.
That's very odd.
That part was weird, but we saw that with our sheep. We used to see that with our sheep. You know, the coyotes would come and they'd kind of hang out and just look at them, and the sheep would sort of go about their day, and
the coyotes would
move in a little bit. And so, do you think the cows do that too?
Oh yeah, there's got to be some either some action or some noise that we're not hearing that's different that the cows pick up on or the sheep pick up on, and they seem to not note that that's not a threat today, but that changes also after you've been a cow that's had a very bad experience with a wolf. And that's what the ranchers were telling us, is that the demeanor of these cows changed drastically. And that we, ask us if we could put science to that. So we took 50 cows out of the ranch that was being hit the hardest, actually. It's a good-sized ranch, 28 wolves on his place in that year of 2009. And really, he lost approaching... over 60 calves. I think it was around 10 or 12 cows and some yearlings as well. And so it was a very heavily impacted herd of cows, let's say that. And we asked for the help of the Eastern Oregon Ag Experiment Station, and we took 50 of those cows in the fall after they'd been gathered, and sent them over to Burns where there were no wolves, and we mixed them in with 50 cows from the experiment station where they hadn't had any experience at all, and we ran them together for 50 days to try to get some sort of, you know, equality between the management, at least in the short term. And once a week, they ran those cows through the chute just to get them all familiarized with what would happen there. After 50 days, we took them in one morning and ran them through the chute and put a thermistor in their bodies, and you know, so that we could keep track of body temperature, and took a blood cortisol level. Basically, took a blood sample, and when an animal or a warm-blooded person is scared, the cortisol level goes up in blood just instantaneously. And then we did what's called a temperament score, and that was a chute score, which if you've ever worked livestock, if you put a cow in the chute and squeeze her down, some cows will just stand there, and that'd be a one, and some cows never quit fighting. They're just fighting until you open the gate. That'd be a five. And then you open the gate, and they had an electronic eye out in front to see how quickly they exited. And, you know, some of them hadn't hit the ground for a while, and the others wander out. So you put those two scores together, and you get a temperament score of just how much, you know, how agitated is a cow. We took them back, put them in their pen together, and they were split into three pens or four pens, I don't remember which, with some of wolves, you know, some wolf cows and what we called the con cows, ones that had never been around wolves, in each pen. And then we turned on a wolf howl box, so that there was a wolf howling in relatively close, similar area. We took large dogs, German Shepherd type dogs, and walked them up and down the alley in front of the feed bunks. We took wolf urine and put it in an absorbent material and hung it on the fence so that there would be both all smell, sight, and sound occurring. Did that for 20 minutes. Then we ran them back through the chute. And there was a statistically valid difference on every one of those things that we were testing. And so we basically proved what the cowboys were telling us, which science does a lot, by the way. The cowboys come in and tell us what's happening, and then we try to identify if that can be scientifically documented. And we did. We found that the body temperature went up on the wolf cows, and it didn't on the con cows, the cows that had never been around wolves. And the same thing happened with the blood cortisol level was significantly different, shot up in the wolf cows and didn't in the others. And then the temperament score is interesting. You run these cows through the chute, and then you take them back, and you do something to them for 20 minutes, and then you take them running through the chute. The cows get tired. So the temperament score, interestingly, didn't go up on the cows that were with wolves. They stayed the same, but the temperament score from the other cows went down. They were tired, and they didn't fight near as much. They weren't as agitated. So statistically valid differences, that's been published in the Journal of Animal Science already, and it's out there. And the key to that, the reason that's important is you can then go to the rest of the other published research. And when body temperature goes up and blood cortisol level goes up and your temperament changes, there's an impact to your production. And we can get into that, you know, in the future here a little bit. But your conception rate goes down, your weaning weight goes down, your body condition score goes down. Those are physiological changes that occur when you have a increase in the agitation of these cattle. Another significant issue is that ranchers that live in canyons use dogs a lot to help move the livestock. And once you start with too many wolves interactions out there, then you have to quit using your dogs because all the cows want to do is turn and fight the cows, fight the dogs when you try to use them. So significant issues, another one I call it the master's research, but very important in identifying that these temperament changes on these livestock.
It's amazing how there are so many changes that people don't really think of when you introduce a predator of this type. When we come back, could you let us know how this would differ from, say, a large, you know, coyote population in an area? I kind of think I know the answer, but I'd rather hear yours. Anyway, we will be right back. We're talking to John Williams from Oregon State University, chatting about wolves and their impact on ranching and cattle and ultimately your ability to get beef and afford it. Oh, you're going to like this song, I think. Sounds kind of funny.
The cattle are prowling, the coyotes are howling, way out where the dog is bold. Where spurs are a-jingling, a cowboy is singing this lonesome cattle call.
Unfortunate.
Hey, John, I want to back up just a little bit. Earlier when you were talking about collaring these animals, did you say that the wolf collars have the SD chips in them, or was that just the cow collars?
Well, I they both have them in it.
So
our wolf collars just have the SD card, just like you put in your
right.
camera, you know. And we actually had to get back the collar off the wolf as well to get our data.
So my question there is, well, actually two questions. One is, you have to catch the wolf to get the information out off the card, which I'm not sure how difficult that is. That sounds like it would be quite a chore. And I think the wolf, every time you did that, would probably get a little smarter on how not to get caught. And what is the change in the temperament of the wolf after he's continually being handled by people?
Continually being handled. He was caught once and had the collar put on him.
Okay.
And we actually have these collars going off on the wolf once every 15 minutes. And we have the collar going off with the cows once every 5 minutes.
All right.
And the reason for that is all about battery life. Now, we knew we were going to get those cow collars back in the fall after 6 to 8 months. On the wolf, we didn't know whether it might be 2 to 3 years before we would get our wolf collar
back.
Okay,
all right.
And so we set it up so it would have 3 years of battery life. You can call it fortunately or unfortunately, whatever. The first winter, that wolf got in trouble. And we get our collar back. He wasn't caught the second time; he was killed.
Okay.
And so we went and gathered the collar after he'd been shot. So,
well, aren't the wolf collars like a radio collar, so that way they can track them, or do they get the data at the end?
If you're talking the state collars, there are two kinds of collars. There's a radio collar that I talked about that's line of sight and about up to about 5 miles out, and you go out with an antenna and you wander around until you hear a beep, and then you can find where he's at. And there's no recording or anything. That's just it emits a radio signal that you can go find the wolf. The GPS collars is what everybody hears about. It has an SD card in it. It downloads it and stores that data on the wolf, and then however often they have it set. In Oregon, it's once every 24 hours. The satellite goes down and, connects with the caller and uploads the last 24 hours worth of data. And so they have it in about a 24-hour time frame.
Oh, okay.
The type of wolf caller that we use for our research doesn't have the capability to upload it. It does, but your battery life can get questionable, and so we don't use it.
Mm, okay, that makes sense. Well, because I know that I can't remember if it was you had said that or someone else, but when they handle the wolves to change the batteries and the, you know, as an ongoing basis, they become really familiar with people, and that presents a real risk to humans.
Well, there's a couple of things going on there. One is, like when the first wolves were turned out, of course, they'd been habituated to being in pens and hauled around and so forth, so they had pretty much little to no fear. But on the other side, then after they're turned out, they're covered and protected by the Endangered Species Act and by the various wolf plans. And here in Oregon, and the wolves you have in California, there's nothing humans can do to hurt them legally.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they have no need to learn to fear humans. And so it isn't just those with collars on them. None of the wolves tend to have any knowledge that a human is harmful to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
which isn't so good for us.
Our data shows in Willamette County that wolves will come right within, you know, come into the corral next to the barn, which is next to the house. And we've actually had a kill that's almost that close to a house. So,
yikes.
One of the things we looked at in, you know, other little kind of what can you glean from your data, we looked at the wolf data that we had and said, how do the number of dots on the landscape compare to the presence of houses? And so with our data, we calculated it, and it was a straight line. There was nothing we could find in our data that showed that the presence of a house changed at all where a wolf went on the landscape.
Well, that's comforting for the people who live out in a rural area.
Well, it kind of calls into question that we need to take a further look at, well, get them in close to your houses,
yeah,
and they'll be safe.
Yeah, well, and that they're not a danger. That's the big thing, is they are a danger.
Our data is not showing that. So
nice. We're going to come back. We're going to learn a lot more about your data, and we're going to get into the cost figures associated with this, which I think people find very illuminating. You're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.